a train a coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealers honking. Don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord.
Welcome to Profiles. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Eugene Gloria. Eugene was born in Manila, Philippines, and raised in San Francisco, California. He is the winner of the 1999 National Poetry Series for his book, Drivers at the Short Time Motel. He has received the Asian American Literary Award, as well as the Pushcart Prize, and was a recipient of a Fulbright Fellowship. He currently teaches at DePauw University, and his most recent book, published by Penguin, is Hoodlum Birds. Welcome, Eugene.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Eugene, you were born in the Philippines and then moved to San Francisco. Tell me a little bit about growing up in San Francisco, what that was like for you, having come from Manila.
Well, we came to San Francisco in 1966. My whole family, my parents and my brothers and sisters, there's six kids in the family. I'm the youngest. And I was about nine at the time. And it was a really exciting time, as you can imagine. 1966, San Francisco. The next year, 1967, the Summer of Love.
Uh-huh.
I went to school at a Catholic school, St. Agnes Elementary School, which is on Ashbury Street near Frederick. So it was right in the heart of all that. And so growing up near Golden Gate Park was really an exciting time for me, too, and being there with this kind of excitement that I'm still trying to process right now. In fact, it's something that I'm working on for my next collection, that experience growing up, that period in time.
What was that change of cultures like for you, or was it not such a great change from Manila to the Summer of Love in San Francisco?
Well, it was strange because growing up in the Philippines, America has always been part of your experience growing up there. And so I had this image of America, which is probably more akin to what Indiana is, you know, in my imagination. So going to San Francisco was really exciting because it was not what I had imagined. It was very multicultural. Across the street from our flat was a Baptist church. And so it was a very colorful experience seeing African-American women, you know, on Sunday dressed to go to church. The hippie scene was very big in the Haight. And then seeing a lot of Filipinos at the time there, especially in the elementary school where I went. So I grew up with Filipino kids, other Asian kids, African American kids. So it was exciting. It wasn't what I had expected.
Did you speak Tagalog at home or another language? Or
yes, I spoke Tagalog at home. And being a child, I think it was easy for me to sort of adjust to English, watching television, talking to my classmates. I think that was very easy to adapt.
What was it like to move to the center of the country, to Greencastle, Indiana?
Well, my first experience in the Midwest was when I moved to Ohio when I went to graduate school. I went to Miami of Ohio. And so that was a radical experience for me. So that's actually my first exposure in the Midwest. Coming from New England and then to Indiana wasn't as radical. I lived in New England before coming to Indiana, so I made this sort of circuitous trip to end up in Indiana.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. Our guest is poet and associate professor of English at DePauw, Eugene Gloria, and I'm your host, Shauna Ritter. Eugene, what brought you to poetry? When did you first start writing, and why poetry?
I didn't really set out to be a poet. That's not my original plan. so it was actually quite accidental. I know it's probably a cliche to say this, but it's poetry more or less discovered me rather than the other way around. I wanted to be a lawyer when I was an undergraduate. My father was a lawyer. I come from my father's family. Many of them are lawyers and educators. And so that was sort of a path that was carved out for me in a way. And I and I found it quite romantic, actually. But I
being a lawyer,
being a lawyer, romantic. Right? Not being
not
a poet.
Being a poet.
That was never in the equation, actually, when I was growing up, up until I was in college. But I always loved literature. I always loved reading, and I was an English major and a poli-sci major, and I was always attracted to the contemporary American writers, the modern writers, Hemingway and Fitzgerald and that whole crowd, you know. I found them very exciting.
What excited you about them or what attracted you to them?
It was just this exalted language that really fascinated me. And even when I was studying literature at the time, I never really imagined myself being part of that experience. I've always just sort of appreciated the fact that I was a reader. And, you know, I secretly wrote poetry. I kept a journal. I had this amazing eighth grade teacher who turned me on to writing in a journal. And I think that's what really started it. I started writing, and I would write secretly, write poems secretly. But they weren't very good, of course. And I never really read it to anybody. I was too embarrassed. But it wasn't until actually going to graduate school when I actually started even thinking about it. It was just by accident that my classmates encouraged me to take a creative writing workshop instead of the literature courses I was taking at Miami at the time. I was going for an MA in literature at the mm-hmm. time. And so I just sort of got coerced into a writing workshop, and that sort of got me started. So I like to say, in a way, writing for me actually began in the Midwest. So there's that weird Midwest connection.
So you're a Midwestern Filipino via San Francisco writer.
I think that makes sense to me, yeah.
Why poetry as compared to fiction? The writers that you first mentioned being drawn to, both Faulkner and Hemingway, were fiction writers.
I never really had a knack for fiction, I think. And I think poetry just came naturally when I started writing it. And my workshop teachers were poets, and so... they're very encouraging of my early attempts at writing, and I just never really turned back, and I just sort of followed that path, and I discovered other poets who turned me on. I mentioned William Carlos Williams; he was one of my early favorites. Just the whole plainness of language sort of invited me right in, one of my early favorite poems was. A poem by Ezra Pound, and I didn't really know much about Ezra Pound, but he had this translated poem, The River Merchant's Wife, which I really, really loved. And I for me, that was my template. That's the poem I always wanted to write.
What did you love about that poem?
It was really romantic without being sentimental. It was a beautiful love poem, and it told a story, and it was easy for me to latch onto that narrative. And that feeling of longing sounded really familiar to me from hearing stories from the Bible and growing up a Catholic. You know, it reminded me of Lot's wife, which really fascinated me early on. That whole idea of being punished for looking back at your home. Mm-hmm. And there was something about looking back in that poem too that I thought meant something to me very deeply at the time when I first read it.
Hmm. And does that poem still hold for you now as being one of your favorite pieces?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I can't really get into the cantos as much, but I go back to that poem and I read it. And then, you know, then I discover, oh, he was just translating it. And he didn't even speak Chinese.
Often on Profiles, we ask our guests to choose a song that's meaningful for them. And one of the pieces you chose, Eugene, was Curtis Mayfield's The Woman's Got Soul. Why'd you choose that one?
I love that song. I love Curtis Mayfield. And it's a really positive song. And it's very uplifting. And Curtis Mayfield has that sort of gospel background that kind of attracted me. It's just so soulful.
She may not be the best looking woman I ever did see, nor have the charms of the ladies of high society, but the woman's got soul worth all money and gold.
Now I'm just a regular fella. I don't need much. I don't need a Cadillac car or diamonds.
We've been listening to The Woman's Got Soul by Curtis Mayfield, and you're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Eugene Gloria. Eugene, tell me a little bit about your writing process. When you start out, do you start out to write a poem? Does it just come to you? Are you one of those writers that, you know, work 4 hours a day in a disciplined way? What's your writing process like?
I wish I could say I'm very disciplined, but I'm not. No, I don't sit down and say, okay, this is going to be a poem. For me, what works is finding that right time to write. And teaching writing, I tell my students, the first thing you need to do is find that moment, that magic moment where you don't have any distractions, where you feel most alert, most attentive. When you come to writing, that's really, you have to find that space. I write usually in the morning. That's when I'm most alert. My wife has gone off to work. It's usually before I teach or it's when I'm not teaching. And it could be just about an hour or 45 minutes, depending on how much time I have that day between grading papers or preparing for my classes. And I write in my journal, and I just write. And I remember hearing Billy Collins say something once that meant a lot to me about his process. And he said, you know, it's like going on a road trip. You know, you just go, and you don't really know what you'll find, but it's really the process of being on that road, being on that journey, and it's really the discovery you make while you're on that trip. So I'm just writing whatever comes out, and sometimes a word will attract me, and something that'll trigger something else, or an image will come from this, or it'll just be a total waste of time, and that's fine. I mean, I think that's something that I just continually build on and move on. So sometimes a wonderful moment will happen and a poem will come out from that writing exercise.
How different is the revision process for you than the writing process? You know, you talked about sitting down and seeing what happens and following the road wherever it leads you. But then there's that other process when you're actually thinking about a poem as being something for other people's eyes as well. How do you – what happens between those two pieces?
I think that's a separate discipline. I think the revision process is a more maniacal, more obsessive process, and you really have to be very hard on yourself when you're at that point. And one of the first lessons I learned as a student in writing was to never fall in love with my own words, and that's the first thing I have to get over. And so I put it aside. When I have a sense of a poem and I've written it as a poem, then I put it aside and come back to it later on, and then come back to it more aggressively and take out things that seem excessive or doesn't fit and work from there. And sometimes it'll take a year, sometimes longer. To give you an example, I'm working on a poem right now, and I the idea came to me around January, and I'm still working on it, and it's been a couple of months, and I'm still not happy with it, and so I'm still working it out. But I'm giving myself a deadline to finish it because it's going in my next collection, and so I have to submit that pretty soon. So it's going to have to end somehow, that process of revision. But I'm almost there. I'm happy where it is, but not entirely happy.
Other than a self-imposed deadline or an externally imposed deadline, how do you know when something's done?
I don't think you ever really know. I know you've probably heard that a million times. You know, the whole idea of writing is so mysterious that how a sequence of words can become a poem is really a mysterious process. And sometimes it feels just right and you're ready to stop and say, okay, that's it. And then sometimes you'll just always have doubts about it. And there's the deadline and it's over and it's done. And sometimes you have to respect that, and then sometimes you try to make yourself feel better by saying, well, I can always come back to that poem and fix it later on. Sometimes I do, and I have done it after a poem has been published and I've gone back to something and worked on it. So it all depends, really.
Well, I'd like to ask you to read one of your poems for us. What would you like to read?
I'll start with this poem. It's a longish poem. It's called One Train. One train. At Estación Abando in Bilbao, Daylight bathes the cramped sleeper car for two. The couple slept in separate berths. Don't look at them for too long, because you might see yourself in their faces. At this moment, I am one of them, about to be remanded to that place between waiting and remembering. A burst of broom lines the breakdown lane. The big-breasted woman, with a switch trailed by sleepwalking dogs, herds Holstein cows. Memory tethers me to this earth. I remember being 26 or 27 when the woman I had been seeing confessed one day that she had been sleeping with someone else. For some, truth is a serum of sweet sensation that floods the body until it is reduced to a wisp of smoke. For others, truth is the weight of oceans, the sound of bridge cables snapping. My knees weakened, and whatever held me up buckled and released. All I wanted to do was to lie down, a spill of water on the ground. Nothingness is the tactile testimonial of stars. It is a voice in the graveyard shift, a radio show of old songs, a desire to retrace footsteps like children bent on turning back time. I had drunk too much and wandered into a yard, long with benches where children sit to eat sandwiches from pails with a thermos of milk. Above me, only hints of stars, with the city lights allowed of the sky. Every time I see you falling, I get down on my knees and pray. I didn't know it, but I was crowing like dim birds in the night. On my way, I ran into a woman jumping out of a car. She was inconsolable, arms around her chest, tears on her face. When she got closer, I held out my pint of Jack Daniels and said, "Maybe you could use this." She looked at me up and down, took the bottle from my hand, then followed me to my apartment. I was 26 or 27 when only things like this could happen. I'm sorry for telling you, but that's how it was. She was pale and paler there in the dark. We were like an old couple, going through the motions of undressing and slipping into the covers. She had small breasts, her butt round and firm, her body a shadow of my own. We didn't talk afterwards. She never gave me her name. I remember a story about a man who gets off a train and decides that this is the town where he will live for the rest of his life. All that remained from his past he kept inside a room in which even the woman he married, who loved him more than herself, never entered. Lives entire, companion with people we hardly know. If I could return to that night, I would change nothing. Perhaps someone should tell the couple entering the new city to endow the mystery that awaits them. Go ahead, look at them as you see yourself holding on.
Thank you, Eugene. That was One Train from Hoodlum Birds. There's so many lines that I'm struck with, and especially the one, it was towards the beginning of the poem that says, "remanded to that place between waiting and remembering." Can you talk a little bit about what that place is between waiting and remembering?
I think it's that, I don't know if we're allowed to say it anymore, but I think it is that magic time that I'm trying to describe that happens in writing a poem when you're really trying to explain something to someone, a kind of story that is very mysterious to you, but you're trying to explain it anyway. And you don't know it either, but you're just going ahead and trying to express something about it. Waiting and remembering in that line, I think suggests, okay, this is a point where I'm going to stop and tell you a story. This is where I'm going to break into a kind of memory. And I think that's what happens in the poem, that we're no longer in the train station in Spain. We're back in San Francisco where this thing happens, and I'm no longer on the road. I'm no longer walking on the Camino. I'm no longer with my wife about to go to Bilbao.
You also talk about different ways of viewing truth in the poem. How important is it for writing to be truthful?
One of the things I tell my students is this line, and I'm probably misquoting it, from Richard Hugo. And he has this book called The Triggering Town, which is a great book that many creative writing teachers use. And I think the line goes, you owe reality nothing, but the truth of your emotions everything. You have to figure that out for yourself. I think it's really being truthful, but it's not journalism. Mm-hmm. And it's the truth of your emotions is really what matters. So I think you're being truthful to yourself in explaining a kind of memory, and memory is unreliable. So you're being true to memory, but then memory can be betraying you too.
Thank you. You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter, and our guest is Eugene Gloria. Eugene, you mentioned a few minutes ago that when you were writing this poem, you were walking the Camino de Santiago, I'm taking it to be, mm-hmm. in northern Spain, which is the pilgrim's route, right, to Santiago de Compostela. How long did you walk that for, and what was your experience of that?
I didn't do the whole walk. I think to do the whole walk would have probably taken me about 2 to 3 months, because you basically walk from one end of the country to the other.
And through the Pyrenees, through part of the Pyrenees.
Right, exactly. Many of the pilgrims begin in the Pyrenees, and then they work their way down into the border. I was in Pamplona, near the border, and I started there because I was invited to give a reading at a university there, University of Nevada. And so I started there, but I took a train and took buses. So I did see most of the route, but my actual walking began right in Galicia. And I started where it would have been 100 kilometers. And I think that's the minimum that a pilgrim can walk to make it an official pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela.
What you also spent time in Spain after your Fulbright as well. And what is it that draws you to Spain?
Well, you know, I went to Spain, actually, the first time was in 1982. It was right after I graduated from college, and I didn't really know much about Europe. And it was a very cliche thing, you know, backpack, you know, staying in youth hostels. And one of the countries I discovered when I was traveling in Europe by myself at the time was Spain. And Spain, to me, felt like a homecoming without a home, take a line from Derek Walcott. It's a beautiful experience for me because it seems so familiar.
And that had to do with Spain's occupation of the Philippines?
Yeah, 350 years of Spanish colonization. And so the language sounded familiar to me. The food was familiar to me. And I felt confident being there in a way, even though I didn't really speak Spanish very well. I took 4 years of Spanish in high school, but at that point I'd forgotten most of it.
Let's listen to another piece of music that you chose, which is Camarón de Isla, who is a flamenco singer from Spain. And why did you choose this singer?
He is the most soulful man I have ever heard. I discovered Camarón when I was in Spain, not the first time I was there, but maybe after 3 or 4 times after. I loved that sound, and I didn't really know who to look for exactly. And so I just blindly went to a record store and asked the record clerk. I said, "Who is the boss of flamenco singing?" And she took me to this album, and it's an old album. I think it came out in the 70s, and I listened to it. And I thought, yeah.
Ramón, de lo que tú a mí más eso, a nadie contaré nada, de lo que tú a mí más eso, confiesa a Dios la verdad.
We've been listening to Camarón de Isla, a flamenco singer from Spain, and you're listening to Profiles. Our guest is Eugene Gloria, and I'm your host, Shauna Ritter. Eugene, talk to me a little bit more about how place has influenced your writing. You've traveled quite a bit, and you have an influence of various cultures coming into your writing. How does place play a role in your poetry?
Place is almost like a character that you have to deal with. And it's like when you're writing a piece of fiction, you know, place is another character in that work. For me, place in poetry is significant because it's what triggers, I think, many of the poems. In my case, going to the Camino, for example, is a way for me to put behind the complications of my regular life, my daily life, my responsibilities at home, my job, all the complexities that we usually deal with. And just being on the Camino is, you're just a pilgrim among other pilgrims. So place in that way is an invigorating experience, and it's, for me, it inspires many of the poems. I think in my book, people have said that many of the poems feel very lonely, and I think it has more to do with the moment when the poems were being composed, that you're in a very lonely position, in a very lonely space. But actually being somewhere, going to a place that's not familiar to you, what happens, I think, is it triggers your senses to be most attentive. And I think that's a good thing. It's also being in a place that you're not familiar with is that sense of uncertainty that I think also is the realm of poetry writing. And so for me, it is a good place to begin, being in Spain or being in the Philippines or being in an unfamiliar place.
And how does culture play a role for you? Because you carry with you, obviously, being Filipino,
right,
being brought up in America, and then the Philippines itself having a mixture of many different cultures within the Philippines and then those cultures that occupied the Philippines. How does culture play out?
Well, with that experience of place, there's that other experience of displacement. Going to Spain, I was very conscious of how I looked and how people perceived me. And it's something that I'm always very conscious of, being dark-skinned and being Filipino. But for me, Spain was enriching because they were very familiar with Filipinos. I think they allowed Filipinos to assimilate easier than other visitors in that country because they worship the same God. They went to the same churches. Many of the Filipinos who moved to Spain were Catholics, obviously. So it was a very easy assimilation for them. But for me, I wasn't like those Filipinos in a way because I was American. I was Asian. I was a different. I was Asian American. I was Filipino American. So there was that other identity as well.
And how does that influence, do you think, your writing in terms of the tone of your writing, the content of your writing, the rhythms of your writing?
I think the rhythms come from walking, come from whenever I go to a different place. I'm always walking a lot because I'm afraid to take the buses, you know, because I know I'll get lost or take the trains. So I end up walking a lot like a madman. You're walking everywhere. But it's actually something that makes me think about my poems, you know, when you're physically moving. It's like moving along the lines of your poem. I don't know. I think as far as the tone you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
I think the music of the place also plays into the writing as well. But I think the most important experience for me is just being in a different place where my attention is most acute. And so I go somewhere and write down what I'm experiencing. And it's not so much that I go to a place to write about it, but it allows me to remember things that I don't normally think about. And I think a poet, in the act of remembering, is really a process of creating your identity. That process of memory, that process of remembering, is really defining who you are.
So Sounds like it would be a good time to hear another poem.
Okay.
Are you reading also from Hoodlum Birds in this, which is your newer book?
Okay. Since I was talking about, I'll read Flash Ilorde, since we were talking about Filipinos and San Francisco. This is a poem that takes place in San Francisco. Flash Ilorde. It was in the city that had no autumns where Flash Ilorde landed a wacky left hook. Harold Gomez's jaw popped like a dim light bulb, and he stayed down a full 70 seconds after the bell. This is a story of the old uncles from the Valley of Artichokes who threw out their backs for 15 cents an hour. Summertime, the old uncles flocked to the canneries, then returned during the harvest months to cut artichokes, the fragmented syntax of their stories yellow with age, like saved news clippings with a photo of a boxer raised on the shoulders of men with slick back black hair, or a crew cut like their idol with a lightning bolt on his trunks. For decades, I believe that Flash Ilorde had retreated into Midwestern obsolescence to some armpit town with two train silos and a quarry, where a misplaced old uncle could be seen on the square emerging from the pharmacy. He'd be soft in the middle, more like our local pharmacist, than like the aging but fit high school coach married to the church organist. That was the fiction we spread to forget the stories kindred with fish sauce and Del Monte canned sardines. The old uncles yellowing like wallpaper in downtown flop houses. But in 1956, they put on their suits and laid down their cutting knives, stood up from stoop labors to board a bus for San Francisco. All true stories are autumnal. In 1956 on South Van Ness, just beyond the crotch that split the mission near DuBose, Flash Ilorde won six fights at the old mission gardens, the year captured in the yellowing photograph in a news clipping someone saved, showing him caught by the camera's lens in a sea of black hair, arms raised in excess like summer gold.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm going to ask you to trace that poem for me a little bit. You know, just talking about the writing process, thinking about that specific poem, how did you come to write it? Where did the idea come from initially? And how did you go about developing that?
Well, that's a very interesting question for me because I'm not really a researcher per se, but I am intrigued by the process of researching something. And I remember Flash Ilorde when I was a little kid in the Philippines. He was one of the national heroes in the 60s because he was so successful as a boxer. I mean, he was, I think he was a middleweight, light middleweight champion for years. And he was Filipino. Mm-hmm. And so he was a big deal. But I didn't really know much about him. And then years later, I'm reading Philip Levine's memoir, The Bread of Time. And I mistook this short story as a work of nonfiction because I thought this is his memoir. So he has a story there. I think it's called The Key. And one of the characters in his story is Flash Ilorde, who was this high school coach married to who I thought was Philip Levine's mother. And I thought, oh, that's what happened to Ilorde. He married Levine's mom. And so it was very strange. So I believed that for a long time because I was not very smart. And then I of course, did a little bit more research and made some more discoveries. And I found this, the Chronicle, I was visiting San Francisco at the time, and the Chronicle had this retrospective of Flash Ilorde, and there's a little article that I cut out. And then I discovered that after he retired, he went back to the Philippines and he became this wonderful, generous man who built schools for children and maintained the status of being a really good citizen. And so that's where the poem began, talking about sort of rediscovering this national hero, this intriguing Filipino who – and the other layer of discovery was that, oh, I didn't even know that he fought in San Francisco, which was another connection for me. And mm-hmm. and so I thought, oh, this is definitely something that it's calling out to me. And that's when I started working on the poem.
So you wrote sort of a narrative story, so to speak, based on your research. And then how did you go about developing that into what looks like a poem with stanzas and line breaks and punctuation and accentuation, et cetera?
I'm always interested in image. And so the poem began with this image of yellow. And I think it had something to do with the yellowing newspaper clipping that I saved. And over time, it started to yellow. So that was one image I was working on. Another image that that was very important for me at the time when I was writing a lot of these poems was the idea of a hand. And so hands are very important notions, images for me. And I think in the collection, Hoodlum Birds, I don't know if I did this purposely or if it just ended up that way, but there are all these motifs of hands. So working with those two images, I think, is one way to begin. It started out as a kind of a narrative that I wrote in my journal. I never really write a poem with line breaks. They just sort of run into each other. And then I start thinking about what image to begin with, what image to close with. I learned somewhere that image is sort of the natural speech of the imagination. So that's really what I was trying to privilege. So I was working with image mostly, and then working in some aspect of story about my sense of discovering him, making that connection to San Francisco. And so those were things that I worked and reworked. And so I think that poem took me quite some time until I finally got it published, but it took several drafts, maybe a year or so.
There was another line about truth in there that I was really struck with, which is that true stories are autumnal. And at the beginning of the poem, you talk about being in a land of no autumns. Mm-hmm. And so I was just wondering how those two seemingly opposites came to be in some way.
Well, the idea of not having any autumns is my notion of San Francisco. I know that you lived in San Francisco, so you know that.
What did Mark Twain say? The only place that's green in winter and brown in summer, or the coldest winter I ever spent was August in San Francisco.
Yeah. So we don't really have autumns as we have dramatically here in the Midwest or anywhere else in the East. But I should also confess that the line actually was from Philip Levine's story. So that's a direct theft. And it's interesting because I did confess in front of Levine when I read this poem in Fresno one time, and he was there in the audience, and I knew he was there, and I was very nervous because I was planning to read the poem. I thought, oh, my God, Levine's out there, and he's going to hear this line I ripped off from him.
What did he say?
Nothing. He just had this very sour look on his face. He never said anything about it, but I guess it was okay.
Who are some of the poets and writers you've mentioned, you know, that Faulkner and Hemingway sort of turned you on to literature in a sense because of their language? And you mentioned William Carlos Williams and Ezra Pound as being poets who sort of helped you see poetry or help you develop your sense of poetry. Who are other writers that you read on a regular basis?
Well, I should mention that one of the discoveries I made that actually gave me permission to write was a poet and better known now as a fiction writer is Jessica Hagedorn. She's a Filipino-American writer. She's now in New York, but she was very popular in the 70s, in San Francisco in the Bay Area. And I remember reading one of her poems, and it was a beautiful poem about Smokey Robinson. And I thought, wow, I love Smokey. I love soul music. And here she is. She's Filipino. She's writing about things I'm familiar with. And so making that discovery for me gave me permission early on to write my own poems. But to answer your question, I think some of my favorites, I think, I mentioned Levine. He was mm-hmm. a very important influence in my writing when I was growing up. Growing up in poetry. I love Larry Levis's work, and I think Levis's work sort of infiltrates this work, this collection in many ways. James Wright is one of my other favorites. Elizabeth Bishop, she's everybody's favorite poet. But I think for me she was very helpful because she writes about traveling and this idea of displacement and something very beautifully evocative about her writing that really attracts me too. So I go to her poetry a lot.
How does writing and teaching work together in your life?
I think it works wonderfully together. I teach creative writing, and I think I need to be an active poet in order for me to teach poetry to my students. I just feel more honest about it and in my process of telling them what I do and suggestions I make in their own writing. So I think it works very well. But there's also that other side of the process, too, that where I teach, it's a very teaching-heavy place, which is great for the students. My colleagues are very dedicated teachers, and they give a lot of time to their students, and I do, too. And so that's very important for me to be working with my students. So when I'm teaching, I'm not really writing very much. And so I have to wait in the summertime when I really get a lot of work done, or when I'm on sabbatical, like I am now, which is really this golden time in my life. So that's really when I feel most productive, when I'm not teaching. But I think when I am teaching, a lot of things is feeding my own writing. The books we're reading, the poets we're studying, just constantly talking about the craft, I think, is very important, very nurturing for me as well as for my students.
What are some of the most important things you want your students to walk away with? What understandings about poetry?
I think primarily I want them to understand it as an art, that as an art, you have to give your life to it. And if they're not going to be poets, that's fine with me. I mean, I think that it's good for them to have experienced language in a sort of exalted manner, and to look at it as art and to understand what people have done with that idea of art in literature. But I caution them that if they do want to be serious poets, it's almost giving their life to it. And I don't know really what that entails to them, but it's very seldom that I do find an undergraduate who would say, yeah, I'm going to be a poet for the rest of my life. And some of them end up going to law school, and that's fine because I wanted to go to law school.
You're listening to Profiles on WFIU. Our guest is Eugene Gloria, poet and professor of English at DePauw University, and I'm your host, Shauna Ritter. Eugene, you spoke about giving your life to poetry as an art. What does that entail for you?
I think it entails putting a burden on my relationships with people, particularly my wife, who is very, very supportive of what I do. And for me, I find myself most productive when I go to an artist colony or a residency, and that involves being away for a whole month. I feel very guilty when I do that, when I leave behind someone I care about. In order for me to write my poems with the deep attention that I think my poems deserve. So I think that's one sacrifice, and I think it's also, I don't know, I mean, I think it's sort of like a process of useless concentration. I mean, it's really writing something that's really inconsequential to someone in the realm of commerce, and many of my students want to be in the realm of commerce when they graduate from college and make a lot of money. And, you know, I tell them, look, you're in the wrong game. I mean, you're not going to make any money doing this, but it's a good thing that you're learning poetry. It's good that you develop an appreciation for it. But it's really not something that will enrich you monetarily.
I have to say it's very rare to hear somebody say, I gave up going to law school in order to be a poet. Very often you hear people say, I gave up poetry in order to go to law school. So it's a little bit of the reverse on that, Eugene. You said something about useless concentration. Can you talk a little bit about that more? Because what comes to mind for me when you said that is I'm hearing another voice in my head, which is Carolyn Forché's voice, who said, you know, it's the burden of the poet to tell the story. It's the burden of the poet to bear witness. It's, you know, the poet's job to make sure that they're capturing truth.
Right. There are poets who, like Forché, who I admire, who are political poets, who are poets of witnesses. They've described themselves and others. Milosh is another one. And I think when I say useless concentration, I mean when I'm talking about my own process where I'm not really thinking of anything in particular. I'm not thinking about ways to develop world peace or anything like that. I think that idea of useless concentration is really the most truthful way I can describe writing poetry, because you are devoting yourself to a kind of exalted process, a kind of art. It's also kind of tongue-in-cheek, I suppose, to say it, not to make the whole idea so precious, you know, that you're sitting down, you don't really know what you're doing, and you're trying to write something, and you're waiting for something to happen. And sometimes what you're waiting for doesn't come, but you're paying attention anyway, and you're listening, and you're waiting. And for some, that's kind of useless when you can be devoting your time to something more productive.
I want to take time to listen to the other song that you chose, which is People Get Ready, also by Curtis Mayfield. Why did you pick this song?
Oh, it's an anthem. It's an anthem of the 60s. It's an anthem of the civil rights movement. And that's a lot of where my head is at right now. The poems I'm writing is sort of going back to that time. As I mentioned earlier, I'm going back to 1967, and that was the kind of music that was going on at the time. I love Curtis Mayfield, and I really didn't discover him until much later in the 70s when I saw Superfly. But then, you know, I got smarter and said, hey, man, this guy's doing something more interesting before Superfly. Not that Superfly wasn't a great album, but I love those anthem music that came from the 60s.
Now, you were really young in 1966, right? You were still in elementary school?
Yeah.
So were you in Golden Gate Park for part of the great B-ins and the love-ins? You know, Jefferson Airplane playing and Grateful Dead and...
Well, yeah, they were all in the neighborhood. I mean, I saw the B-ins. I didn't know what was going on. I didn't understand it. My neighbor, who's Filipino, used to sew... I would call them costumes that Sly and the Family Stone wore in their concerts. And so I knew about Sly and the Family Stone from her. So all that was familiar to me, and I was around 10 at the time. And so my memories are pretty strong at that time already. I mean, or going back, I remember quite a few things. And I think the project came from an idea from Susan Orlean, who said that men at 40 define themselves from what they were when they were 10. And so I kind of ran with that idea that I need to go back when I was 10 and figure out what I was like when I was 10 and what the world was like when I was 10 to sort of define where I'm going right now in my late 40s.
And you mentioned that you were the youngest of six. So mm-hmm. Were your brothers and sisters involved in the scene in San Francisco?
They were in high school. My brothers and sisters, they were going to Polytechnic High, and which is very exciting place at the time, but they weren't necessarily in the scene. I mean, we were immigrants, you know, and so we weren't really assimilated that well yet in the country to be partaking in the peace movement or anything like that. And my sister, who was very, very smart, she was valedictorian in high school, got a scholarship to go to Berkeley, but my mom wouldn't let her because she didn't want my sister to be a radical.
You mentioned before that image is the natural speech of the imagination, if I'm using the phrase correctly. Mm-hmm. What images come to your mind from that time that you're working with on your new work that you're writing right now?
A lot of it is our childhood memories. The store where I used to go and buy toys and candy, where I used to hang out, Golden Gate Park, the elementary school where I went. Mostly they're memories of family, and they're not so much memories about what people naturally think of the 60s, but they're memories of a Filipino family in San Francisco and trying to make a mark or trying to start from an experience in America. And so it's like many of my work, really. It's sort of revisiting my memories and trying to define who I am from those memories.
People get ready, there's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealers honing. Don't need no ticket,
just thank the Lord. So people get ready for the train to Jordan, picking up passengers coast to coast.
You've been listening to Profiles on WFIU with our guest Eugene Gloria, poet and associate professor at DePaul University. I'm your host, Shauna Ritter.
The program you just heard was recorded in March of 2007. The studio engineer and technical producer was Michael Paskash. Emily McCord was our research assistant. Copies of this or other programs can be obtained by calling 812-855-1357. More information about Profiles, including archives of past shows, can be found on our website at wfiu.org. Profiles is a production of WFIU and comes from the studios at Indiana University. Christina Kuzmich, executive producer. Please join us again for the next edition of Profiles. For WFIU, thanks for listening.